an expenditure of powder and bullets. Nothing much came of it. But it had the effect of leaving Otis Howard late that afternoon, quite isolated and alone, on the Union right. Jackson's column had moved resolutely forward, in secret and in silence, cutting an elliptical arc around the Union right. The Second Corps had taken the Catherine Furnace Road, then the Welfords Road, then a series of narrow byways that had finally rejoined the Brock Road, which had put their lead at the Orange Plank Road in mid-afternoon. Except for the open area near the furnace, they had remained unseen and undetected. Every path and byway that went off to the right had been sealed off by Stuart's horsemen. According to the plan Lee and Jackson had developed, the column would turn right at the intersection of the Brock and Plank Roads. From there, the Union right was supposed to be about 2 miles to the east. To see if this was true, the 2nd Virginia Cavalry, under Tom Munford, conducted a reconnaissance up the Plank Road. They soon found a piece of high ground from which a Confederate captain saw a view rarely afforded to any scout. He galloped back to find Fitzhugh Lee, who saw it too, then himself galloped back to find Jackson, who was riding at the head of Robert Rhodes's column. Lee drew rein and said, "General, if you will ride with me, halting your column here, I will show you the enemy's right." Minutes later, Jackson was gazing down upon a major piece of the Union Army, not 700 yards away. This was Howard's 11th Corps, though Jackson had no way of knowing that. But it was clearly the terminus of the Union right. From the spot where the Orange Plank Road intersected the Orange Turnpike, Jackson could see roughly half a mile of open space on either side. As Fitzhugh Lee recalled, "Below and but a few hundred yards distant ran their line of battle, with abatis in front and long lines of stacked arms in the rear. Cannon in position were visible, and the soldiers were in groups, chatting, smoking, and playing cards, while the ones in the rear were driving up and butchering beeves." Jackson could also see that the Union line was facing south. He thus understood, when it was pointed out to him, that an attack up the Plank Road would amount to a frontal assault. An advance eastward on the Orange Turnpike, on the other hand, which intersected Brock Road a mile and a half to the north, would mean that his own battle line would be almost perfectly perpendicular to the Union line. He turned to Fitzhugh Lee and said, "Tell General Rhodes to move across the Plank Road and halt when he gets to the old turnpike. I will join him there." Rhodes did just that. He turned to the east on the turnpike, continued for a mile to a 400-yard-wide clearing at the farm of John Luckett, and then stopped unnoticed and unmolested by anyone in a blue coat. At about 3 p.m., Jackson wrote out a brief dispatch in his clumsy scrawl for General Lee. "The enemy has made a stand at Chancellor's, which is about 2 miles from Chancellorsville. I hope as soon as practicable to attack. I trust that an ever-kind providence will bless us with great success. Respectfully, T.J. Jackson." He then added a postscript that read with more of his usual deadpan understatement, "The leading division is up, and the next two appear to be well closed." Though the marching had indeed been disciplined, it still took a long time to convert the elongated column to a battle line. It was even harder because most of that line had to assemble in the supposedly impenetrable woods. Over the next 2 hours, Jackson labored to place 21,800 infantry and 8 pieces of artillery into position. This would be his attacking force. The rest would follow behind in reserve. He had plenty of daylight to work with and was able to pay attention to the smallest details. He had never had this luxury before. Roughly half a mile ahead of him, his foes went about their business, suspecting nothing. When Jackson had finished, his battle line was 2 miles long, aimed directly at a Union Army corps that was in most places only a few men deep, facing south. At 5:30 p.m., Jackson was sitting on his horse on the Orange Turnpike next to General Robert Rhodes. His lines were formed and waiting. Though the men had marched some 12 miles and they were in high fighting spirits, they were as yet unaware of exactly what was going to happen. Jackson's veterans knew by now that long marches preceded spectacular events. After surveying his battle lines, he turned to his fellow rider and said, "Are you ready, General Rhodes?" "Yes, sir. came the enthusiastic response. Jackson then said quietly, "You may go forward, then." A bugle call rang through the woods, followed by responses from bugles on the left and right, and suddenly the woods were alive with fast-moving Confederates. As they quick-stepped forward through the tangled undergrowth, which didn't seem to dampen their enthusiasm, the wild, eerie, corkscrewing sound of the rebel yell swept down the ranks. In minutes, they were in range of the Union lines. Though the rough terrain broke up Jackson's neat battle lines, the men did not stop to reform, but pushed forward, singly and in groups. Jackson rode close behind his men, shouting, "Press forward! Press forward!" The speed and direction of the Confederate attack took the 11th Corps completely by surprise. Because of an acoustical anomaly in the forest, they had heard none of the bugle calls. They had been enjoying a moment of drowsy calm and seemingly perfect security. Men were fixing dinner and taking naps, or relaxing, listening to the distant music of a regimental band, or perhaps discussing the Confederate retreat, when suddenly all nature seemed to rise up in revolt around them. Through their camps rushed frantic rabbits, deer, quail, and wild turkeys. Then there was an odd silence. And then Jackson's massive, screaming, onrushing wall of gray was upon them. It was so sudden and so overwhelming that men who were there later used storm or avalanche metaphors to describe it. There was very little they could do about it except to drop what they had and run for their lives. There was an effort made here and there by Union infantry to form and make some sort of fight, but the shock of the assault was too much for most of them. "The surprise was complete," wrote Confederate artillery officer David Gregg McIntosh. "A bolt from the sky would not have startled Brigade Commander Leopold von Gilsa's men half so much as the musket shots in the thicket and the sight of their flying comrades, followed by a straggling line of skirmishers and then by a solid wall of gray. The resistance offered was speedily beaten down. There was nothing left to do but lay down their arms and surrender or flee. Arms, knapsacks, clothing, equipage, everything was thrown aside and left behind. The camp was in wild confusion. Men lost their heads in terror. The road and the woods on both sides were filled with men, horses, and cattle in one mad flight. The rebel yells added terror to the situation." The victory was fast and complete. In an hour and a half, Jackson had shattered the 11th Corps and driven forward a full mile and a quarter to a point less than 2 miles from Hooker's headquarters. The 11th Corps had suffered 2,400 casualties out of 11,000 men, including 1,000 captured. Jackson lost only 800 men. Former VMI professors Rhodes and Colston had led the attack. The dashing Rhodes in particular was a brilliant presence on the field, exhorting his men with his long mustaches flying. Jackson personally congratulated him on his gallant performance. Indeed, Jackson's men had never seen their leader quite so thrilled with a victory. "He was in unusually fine spirits," wrote one Confederate captain, "and every time he heard the cheering of ourselves, which was the signal of victory, he raised his right hand a few seconds, as if in acknowledgment of the blessing, and to return thanks to God for the victory." One Georgian remembered that even after the fighting had died down, the ground seemed to tremble, as if shaken by an earthquake. "The cheering is so tremendous, caused by General Jackson riding along the line." Like the hapless Otis Howard, Hooker had also been taken completely by surprise. He had been busy planning a full-scale pursuit of Lee's supposedly retreating army for the following morning. He'd certainly been curious about the various Confederate advances on the turnpike and the plank road east of Chancellorsville at about 5:30, which was actually Lee demonstrating loudly to cover Jackson's attack. He had had trouble getting Sedgwick to advance as ordered on Fredericksburg, and he still had not heard from George Stoneman. But he was not terribly worried. He would work these things out. At about 6:30 p.m., as he was conversing with two captains on his staff on the porch of the Chancellor House, he heard a sudden noise from the road. One of the captains stepped off the porch, looked through his glass, and shouted, "My God, here they come!" Hooker and his staff rode westward on the road to see what was happening, and immediately encountered the men, horses, and wagons of the 11th Corps in wild panic and full flight. Many had no weapons, hats, haversacks, or coats. They demanded wild-eyed to know how to get to the bridges so they could cross the river to safety. Because almost half of them were German and shouting in their native language, it was hard to tell at first what was going on. Hooker's staffers may have learned at that moment that alles ist verloren meant all is lost. But soon enough they understood that the 11th had been routed, and the Union flank shattered beyond repair. Hooker himself did not panic. He acted quickly. He brought up artillery and pointed it west instead of south, pulled other troops back from the furnace to the turnpike and faced them the same way, and shifted Meade's 5th Corps to protect his lines to the river. He went to work constructing a new west-facing line 3/4 of a mile east of his headquarters. Orders went out that the high ground near Chancellor House, the center of the Army's position, was to be held at all costs. In minutes, Hooker's attitude had changed from serene self-confidence to fear for the safety of his army. He was right to be alarmed. To the west, through the descending darkness, Stonewall Jackson was planning to cut off his retreat and smash him yet again that very night. Chapter 45, An Iron Saber Vowed to an Iron Lord. Jackson was waiting. Though he had already engineered one of the most stunning attacks of the war and its most brilliant single march, he was not satisfied with the ground he had won or that he had driven the 11th Corps clear through the center of Hooker's army and out the other side. He wanted more. He wanted to hit the Yankee defenses on the Plank Road and around the Orange Turnpike, smash through them, and join forces with McLaws and Anderson, while his left swept the Union flank and cut off its main escape route at U.S. Ford. The fact that darkness was falling and night attacks had proved difficult to manage, as at 2nd Manassas, did not seem to trouble him. Because the divisions of Rhodes and Colston that had made the attack were now badly disorganized and commingled, the advance would be led by 5 fresh regiments from A.P. Hill's division under Brigadier General James H. Lane, a former student of Jackson's and colleague on the VMI faculty. In the weirdly still night air, pierced occasionally by the shouts of Union soldiers, Jackson was waiting, he was actually riding restlessly back and forth in the rear of Lane's brigade, for Lane to shake out his regiments into a line of battle. He soon encountered A.P. Hill and some of his staff, and asked his West Point classmate how long it would be before he was ready to move. "A few minutes," Hill replied, "the time it would take to finish bringing his men forward of Rhodes's troops." Jackson assigned his chief engineer, Keith Boswell, to Hill as a guide, then said, "General Hill, as soon as you are ready, push right forward. Allow nothing to stop you. Press on to the United States Ford." Jackson rode forward on the Orange Plank Road, then shifted slightly north to the parallel mountain road. He was now in front of the men of the 18th North Carolina, in the margin between the Confederate lines and Lane's skirmishers, who were deployed several hundred yards ahead. Such personal reconnaissance was an old habit of Jackson's. He liked to scout the battlefield from as far forward as possible. Though this exasperated his staff, who feared for his safety, he persisted in doing it. With him were 8 other riders, including his signal officer, Captain Richard Eggleston Wilborn, his brother-in-law and aide-de-camp, Lieutenant Joseph G. Morrison, a couple of Signal Corps enlisted men, and several couriers. One of them, who lived in the immediate neighborhood and knew the road and terrain well, served as guide. Following them eastward was another mounted group of 9 riders with A.P. Hill. In all, 19 riders went forward into that uneasy, moonlit darkness. Hill, who was following mainly out of military etiquette, lagged about 50 yards behind Jackson. In a remarkable lapse of communication, neither Brigadier General Lane nor the men in his regiments knew that Jackson and Hill were in front of them. Jackson and his fellow riders continued forward, almost to where the skirmishers of the 33rd North Carolina were posted, where they could hear the sounds of Federal soldiers frantically felling trees to build obstructions to slow the rebel advance. To Jackson, this would have been useful intelligence. Jackson listened for a time, then turned back toward the Confederate lines. At that point, he was about 120 yards from his own infantry. It was after 9 p.m. A.P. Hill, still on the plank road, was now about 60 yards behind Jackson on a diagonal line. What happened next happened very quickly. A single shot, fired by a Confederate skirmisher, rang out well to the south of the plank road. Skirmishers on both sides took up the firing, and it rolled in a northerly direction, and several hundred muskets were discharged in short order. Some of the men in the main Confederate line fired too, which meant they were firing at the backs of their own skirmishers. Just as this small-scale firefight reached the center of the Confederate line around the plank road, the men of the 18th North Carolina, who occupied that position, saw what looked like enemy cavalry closing on them from short range. This was Hill, Boswell, and the rest of their group returning to their lines. The infantry, of course, had no idea that there were Confederate horsemen in front of them, least of all A.P. Hill and Stonewall Jackson, and they knew that the mounted figures could not possibly have been their own foot-bound skirmishers. The 18th North Carolina opened fire. Their volleys tore through both Jackson's and Hill's parties. Since Hill was closest to the firing, his group suffered the worst. Two men were shot dead, including Jackson's engineer, Boswell, shot twice through the heart. One mortally wounded, one shot twice in the face, and another severely injured when his horse was killed. The horses of two others were shot and carried their riders helplessly into Union lines, where they became prisoners. Only two staffers were neither killed nor injured, but both of their horses were killed. Hill escaped harm only by lying face down on the ground. Farther off in the darkness where the bullets found Jackson's group, the damage was less severe to individuals and horses, but devastating to the Confederacy and its chances of winning the war. Six of the nine riders with him were untouched by bullets. One of the couriers was killed, another wounded and carried by his horse into Union lines. Then there was Jackson himself, whose astonishing good luck on the battlefield had just run out. He was hit by three bullets. One, a smoothbore round, entered above the base of his right thumb, broke two fingers, and buried itself under the skin on the back of his hand. The other two hit his left arm and were far more destructive. One entered an inch below his elbow and exited just above the wrist. The other hit him 3 inches below the shoulder and completely shattered the bone. His signal officer, Richard Wilborn, seeing that he was hit, managed to rein in the frantic little sorrel, who had initially taken off toward enemy lines, then helped his wounded general to the ground. Soon A.P. Hill arrived, and the two men ripped through Jackson's jacket, pulled off his blood-filled gloves, tied handkerchiefs above and below his shoulder wound, and made a sling for his right arm. The problem was how to get him back to safety. The firing now became more widespread, and Union artillery opened on the suspected rebel advance. With more than a dozen men attending him at various times, Jackson was alternately supported while he walked and carried in a litter. Twice while being carried, he fell to the ground. Once, when one of the litter bearers was shot, again when one tripped and fell. Both falls landed him on his shattered arm, which caused him excruciating pain. He groaned loudly. "At this moment the scene was a fearful one," wrote Hunter McGuire. "The air seemed to be alive with the shrieks of shells and the whistling of bullets. Horses, riderless and mad with fright, dashed in every direction. According to Jackson's aide, James Power Smith, the men were so frightened by the barrage of shell and shrapnel that we were obliged to lay the litter and its burden down as the litter-bearers ran for the cover of the trees. Smith himself lay down next to Jackson, covering him with his own body." At one point, the group encountered Brigadier General Dorsey Pender, who was shocked to see Jackson, and told him he was worried about the damage the federal barrage was doing to his brigade. Jackson, defiant in spite of his wounds, pushed aside the men who were helping support him, raised himself up to his full height, and said in a weak voice, "General Pender, you must hold on to the field. You must hold out to the last." Once behind Confederate lines, Jackson was taken to the ambulance wagon Hunter McGuire had brought up. "I hope you're not badly hurt, General," McGuire said when he saw his pale general. "I'm badly injured, Doctor," Jackson replied in a calm but feeble voice. "I fear I'm dying." After a pause, he went on, "I'm glad you've come. I think the wound in my shoulder is still bleeding." It was. Jackson, in fact, had lost a good deal of blood. His clothes were saturated with it. He had a very faint pulse. McGuire stopped the bleeding, administered some whiskey and morphine, and the ambulance rolled westward toward the field hospital that had been set up half a mile in the rear at Wilderness Tavern. Riding with Jackson in the bed of the wagon was his artillery chief, Colonel Stapleton Crutchfield, who had been wounded in the leg. Jackson was quite concerned about Crutchfield and, according to McGuire, expressed very feelingly his sympathy for his former VMI student. At one point, Jackson reached up and pulled McGuire down to him and asked quietly if Crutchfield was severely injured. "No, only painfully hurt," replied McGuire. "I'm glad it is no worse," said Jackson. A few minutes later, Crutchfield did exactly the same thing and asked McGuire the same question about Jackson. When McGuire told him that the lieutenant general was very seriously wounded, Crutchfield groaned and cried out, "Oh, my God!" Jackson, mistaking this for an expression of agony, ordered the ambulance to stop to see if something could be done to ease his comrade's pain. 2.5 hours later, Jackson's pulse was finally strong enough to allow McGuire to examine the wounds. Before anesthetizing his patient with chloroform, McGuire told Jackson that his left arm would probably need to be amputated and asked if, in the event that was necessary, it should be done immediately. "Yes, certainly, Dr. McGuire," Jackson replied. "Do for me whatever you think best." Jackson was resolutely polite throughout his ordeal. McGuire took off the arm just below the shoulder. At 3:30 a.m., while Jackson was recuperating and with news of his injury pulsing through the ranks, his assistant adjutant, Sandy Pendleton, arrived at the Wilderness Tavern Hospital with an urgent question. After Jackson was wounded, command had passed to A.P. Hill. But Hill himself had been hit in the legs a few minutes later by a shell fragment from the federal artillery barrage triggered by the volleys that wounded Jackson. Hill could not walk or ride, so he had turned over temporary command to Robert Rhodes. But he believed that the command should go to Jeb Stuart, the only other major general left in the Second Corps. Since Lee was too far away to receive a message quickly, Hill dispatched a courier to Stuart with orders to take over. At about midnight, the latter reached the battlefield where Hill, lying under a blanket on the Orange Plank Road with his wounded legs bandaged, told him what little he knew about Jackson's battle plan. Jackson typically had given him only the barest outline. That left Stuart in a quandary. With part of A.P. Hill's division poised for attack, what should he do? He sent Pendleton on an urgent mission to find out. Though McGuire was at first reluctant to let Pendleton see Jackson, he relented when Pendleton explained the seriousness of the crisis. When he entered the tent, Jackson was awake. "Well, Major, I'm glad to see you," he said to his favorite staff member. "I thought you were killed." Pendleton then explained the problem and Stuart's request to know how to proceed. What followed was very likely the product of Jackson's severe trauma and injury, major surgery, and the after-effects of the chloroform, but it was shocking just the same. In McGuire's description, General Jackson was at once interested and asked in his quick, rapid way several questions. When they were answered, he remained silent for a moment, evidently trying to think. He contracted his brow, set his mouth, and for some moments was obviously endeavoring to concentrate his thoughts. For a moment it was believed he had succeeded, for his nostrils dilated and his eye flashed its old fire, but it was only for a moment. His face relaxed again, and presently he answered very feebly and sadly, "I don't know. I can't tell. Say to General Stuart, he must do what he thinks best." Pendleton saluted, left the tent, and wept freely, while McGuire tried to comfort him. The next morning, Jackson was feeling better. He dispatched Anna's brother, Joseph Morrison, to Richmond to arrange for her to come. James Power Smith read him a message from General Lee. "I have just received your note informing me that you were wounded," Lee wrote. "I cannot express my regret at the occurrence. Could I have directed events, I should have chosen, for the good of the country, to have been disabled in your stead. I congratulate you upon the victory, which is due to your skill and energy." Jackson listened, then said, "General Lee is very kind, but he should give the praise to God." His mental clarity seemed to return, too. He wanted to know the details of the battle, how individual brigades or officers had performed, and was pleased to learn that his old Stonewall Brigade had fought gallantly. "The men of that brigade will someday be proud to say, 'I was one of the Stonewall Brigade,'" he said, insisting at the same time that the famous nickname belongs to the brigade and not to me. That same day he told Tucker Lacey that in spite of what had happened, he was perfectly content with his situation. "You find me severely wounded," Jackson said, "but not unhappy or depressed. I believe that it has been done according to the will of God, and I acquiesce entirely in His holy will." "It may appear strange, but you never saw me more perfectly contented than I am today, for I am sure my Heavenly Father designs this affliction for my own good." Later that day, Jackson told Lacey that he had experienced a moment of revelation on the battlefield. "I thought, after I fell from the litter, that I would die upon the field," he said. "And I gave myself up into the hands of my Heavenly Father without fear. I was in the possession of perfect peace." He also spoke about the battle. He said that Hooker had had a good plan, but he shouldn't have sent away his cavalry. That was his great blunder. Of his flank march, he said, "Our movement yesterday was a great success, I think the most successful military movement of my life. But I expect to receive far more credit for it than I deserve. Most men will think I had planned it all from the first, but it was not so. I simply took advantage of circumstances as they were presented to me in the providence of God." Because Lee worried that Jackson might be captured, he ordered his wounded general transported from the hospital at Wilderness Tavern to a private home near Guinea Station, the railroad depot south of Fredericksburg. By now, everyone in the Army of Northern Virginia and in the surrounding areas knew what had happened to him. As he traveled, lying on a mattress in the wagon bed, rough-hewn teamsters stood by the roadside with their hats off, weeping. At Spotsylvania Courthouse and along the entire route, men and women rushed to the ambulance and with tears in their eyes blessed him and prayed for his recovery. The most common sentiment was the one expressed in Lee's note, "I wish it was me, sir." Meanwhile, miles behind him, the battle that he had so brilliantly begun raged through the day. Jackson would have been proud of his men, many of whom cried, "Remember Stonewall Jackson," or "Revenge Jackson," as they advanced against their more numerous enemies. The Confederate attack resumed at 5:30 the next morning. By 10 a.m., Hooker, who had been knocked briefly unconscious when an artillery projectile struck his headquarters, had fallen back to the north, allowing the two halves of Lee's army to unite and ceding critical high ground to the Confederate artillery under Porter Alexander. Soon the Union Army was conducting a fighting retreat to defensive positions near U.S. Ford on the Rappahannock. While this was happening, four Union divisions under John Sedgwick broke through Confederate defenses under Jubal Early at Fredericksburg, took Mary's Heights and the Sunken Road, and advanced west toward Chancellorsville to join Hooker. At 3:30 p.m., Sedgwick attacked and was repulsed by a small Confederate force under Lafayette McLaws. The following morning, Early reoccupied Fredericksburg, and on May 4, Confederate forces under McLaws, Early, and Anderson attacked Sedgwick. Though these attacks were repulsed in the late afternoon, Sedgwick had had enough. He retreated across the river that night. On May 5, Hooker ordered the rest of the army to withdraw to the north side of the Rappahannock. The Battle of Chancellorsville, from Jackson's stunning flank attack to the withdrawal of the immense Union army under cover of darkness, is considered Robert E. Lee's greatest victory. He had won it without Longstreet, and with less than half as many soldiers as his enemy, but at terrible cost. There were 30,500 casualties in all in 3 days of fighting, 17,197 Union and 13,303 Confederate. And the indomitable Jackson was convalescing miles behind the lines. "Jackson has lost his left arm," Lee told Lacey. "But I, my right arm." 50 miles away in Washington, Lincoln's reaction to Hooker's defeat was, my God, what will the country say?" Jackson was taken to a large house known as Fairfield, the residence of the Chandler family, where he was lodged in a tidy, whitewashed outbuilding that looked a good deal like his winter quarters at Moss Neck. Not far away was the bustling Guinea Station, the depot on the Richmond, Fredericksburg, and Potomac Railroad that handled supplies coming north from Richmond and had become a collection point for more than 4,000 captured Union soldiers. Jackson arrived with a cavalry escort at about 8 p.m. after a harrowingly bumpy 27-mile ride through the Virginia outback. When he was greeted by the proprietor, Thomas Chandler, Jackson said in a tired voice, "I'm sorry I cannot shake hands with you, but one arm is gone and my right hand is wounded." Jackson was placed in a double rope trellis bed, ate some bread and drank tea, and fell asleep. Thanks to orders from Lee, Hunter McGuire, one of the finest medical officers in the war, had been released from his other duties to tend Jackson full-time. He, James Power Smith, Joseph Morrison, and Jackson's servant, Jim Lewis, would be the only other occupants of the house. For the next 2 days, Tuesday, May 5 and Wednesday, May 6, he was wounded the night of May 2, Jackson's condition stabilized, then improved. McGuire was pleased with his progress. On Wednesday, Jackson ate heartily and was, in McGuire's words, uniformly cheerful. In his immobilized state, without immediate purpose in his life and free of the usual pull of duty, he became uncharacteristically talkative. He chatted with Lacey, Smith, and McGuire on a range of religious topics that included discussion of how every aspect of a man's religious life should be a self-conscious religious act. While washing oneself, one might imagine the cleansing blood of Christ. While dressing, one might pray to be cloaked in the Savior's righteousness. While eating, to be fed on the bread of heaven. Jackson had long lived this way, consecrating even his most trivial actions to God. Now he had leisure time to discuss his beliefs in detail. He asked his aide, Lieutenant Smith, a former theological student, where the Bible gives generals models for their official battle reports. Smith replied, laughing, that he would never have thought to find such a thing in Scripture. "Nevertheless," said Jackson, "there are such, and excellent models, too. Look, for instance, at the narrative of Joshua's battle with the Amalekites. It has clearness, brevity, fairness, modesty, and it traces the victory to its right source, the blessing of God." He asked James Power Smith what were the headquarters of Christianity after the crucifixion, and asked McGuire if he thought that diseased people who had been healed by Jesus' touch ever suffered again from the same malady. Thus the unusually chatty Lieutenant General passed the first days of his recovery. In the early morning of Thursday, May 7, Jackson's condition suddenly worsened. When McGuire examined him at dawn, he complained of a sharp pain in his side. He had difficulty breathing. His diagnosis? Pneumonia, probably brought on by a contusion of the lung produced by the fall from the litter. Up to this point, plans had been underway to move Jackson to Richmond for the rest of his recovery. Now all that changed. Whether McGuire was right is still a matter of debate. Some present-day doctors think his diagnosis likely. Others think sepsis produced by severe infection was the cause. Others, pulmonary emboli that damaged his lungs. But this was the diagnosis in 1863, confirmed by other doctors summoned by McGuire, and that was what Jackson would be treated for. Pneumonia was a major killer in the Civil War. Some 37,000 soldiers on both sides would die of it. Jackson wasn't going to Richmond. He would have to fight for his life in place at Guinea Station. Joseph Morrison's assigned task, retrieving his sister Anna, was not as easy as it might have seemed. George Stoneman's 10,000 riders were roaming between Fredericksburg and Richmond relatively unchallenged, which meant that Confederate soldiers traveling in that corridor were in automatic danger. Morrison had been forced to hide in the woods and had narrowly escaped capture. It wasn't until the early evening of Tuesday, May 5, nearly 3 days after he had set out, that he finally arrived at the house where his sister was staying. Though she had been told of her husband's wounding, she had received conflicting reports of his condition. Now her brother reported the devastating news that his arm had been amputated. But he was alive and in cheerful spirits, he told her. Unfortunately, what little damage Stoneman's cavalry had inflicted on the RF&P Railroad had just occurred, and all passenger trains had been stopped. Since it was far too dangerous to travel north in a private coach, Anna was forced to wait until Thursday morning, May 7, and even then had to board an armed train that, in her words, was prepared to fight its way through. She traveled with her brother, her 5.5-month-old daughter Julia, the wife of the Presbyterian pastor in Richmond, and Hetty, the Jackson slave who had been Anna's own nurse from infancy. When she arrived at the Chandler house at noon, Anna was told she could not see her husband right away because the doctor was dressing his wound. Frustrated, she was walking off her impatience near the house when she saw a coffin being exhumed from the ground for reburial elsewhere. She inquired about it, only to be told, to her horror, that it was the body of her Lexington neighbor, 35-year-old Frank Bull Paxton, commander of the Stonewall Brigade, who had been shot in the chest and killed on the second day of battle. Anna remembered watching Paxton's young wife weep bitterly when he left home in the early days of the war. Now he would be returning to her in Lexington as a corpse in a wooden box. When she was finally ushered into the sick room, Anna was appalled by what she saw. Only 8 days earlier, she had seen a man, in her own words, in the full flush of vigorous manhood. "I never saw him look so handsome, so happy, or so noble." Now she saw a flushed, gaunt figure in a morphine stupor, with sunken eyes and a mutilated body. His face bore angry scars of hitting tree branches after Little Sorrel had bolted. He had trouble breathing. Nothing had prepared her for his appearance, which, she said, wrung my soul with such grief and anguish as it had never before experienced. He had to be roused to speak to her, and though he expressed much joy and thankfulness at seeing her, he quickly lapsed back into his opiated sleep. She stayed with him for the next several days, leaving only to see her baby. He was now in a semi-conscious state. When awakened, he was able to recognize people in the room and would speak coherently for a few minutes before lapsing into unconsciousness again. "My darling, you must cheer up," he said, "and not wear a long face. I love cheerfulness and brightness in a sick room." He always had something nice to say to her when he woke up. "My darling, you are very much loved," or "you are one of the most precious little wives in the world." He refused to see his daughter Julia, saying, "Not yet. Wait till I feel better." Sometimes when he was still asleep, he spoke as if still in battle. "Tell Major Hawks to send forward provisions to the men," or "order A.P. Hill to prepare for action." He was no better on Friday or Saturday, though by now no fewer than 8 doctors had been brought to consult, including Dr. S.B. Morrison, a cousin of Anna's and a surgeon in Jubal Early's division. Jackson was getting the best medical treatment available, which included drawing blood from his chest, applying mustard plasters, and regular doses of laudanum, a mixture of opium and whiskey. On Saturday, he began to speak more about the possibility of his own death. "I see from the number of physicians that you think my condition dangerous," he said to McGuire, "but I thank God, if it is his will, that I am ready to go." Still, he wasn't sure he wanted to depart just yet. "I do not believe I shall die at this time," he told Anna, after she said she was worried his illness might be fatal. "I am persuaded the Almighty has yet a work for me to perform. I'm not afraid to die. I am willing to abide by the will of my Heavenly Father." He was fading fast. On Saturday night, he asked Anna and her brother Joseph to sing hymns. They sang several, including one of his favorites, Harwell. King of glory, reign forever, thine an everlasting crown. Nothing from thy love shall sever those whom thou hast made thine own. Happy objects of thy grace, destined to behold thy face. Alleluia, alleluia, alleluia. Sunday morning, May 10, 1863, was bright and still. If there had been fleeting moments of hope for Jackson in the last few days, now there were none at all. His illness was crushing him. Doctors McGuire and Morrison examined him, agreed that he did not have long to live, and told Anna, who went into the sick room to tell Jackson the news. He had told her earlier that though he was ready to die whenever God might call him, he would prefer to have a few hours to prepare himself for the moment. It was a difficult task. Jackson had never believed that he was really going to die. "Do you know that doctors say you must very soon be in heaven?" she asked. She repeated words to that effect several times with no response. Then she said, "Do you not feel willing to acquiesce in God's allotment if he wills you to go today?" "I prefer it," he said in a weak voice, and then louder, "I prefer it." "Well, before this day closes, you will be with the blessed Savior in his glory," Anna said. Jackson replied, "I will be an infinite gainer to be translated." But he still struggled to accept his own death. Later, Anna told him again that he would soon be in paradise, to which he replied, "Oh, no, you are frightened, my child. Death is not so near. I may yet get well." Anna, who until now had mostly maintained a stolidly cheerful manner at Jackson's request, now broke down, sobbing. Jackson suddenly snapped out of his drug-induced daze and into focus. He called for Dr. McGuire, who came immediately to his bed. "Doctor," he said, "Anna informs me that you have told her that I am to die today. Is it so?" McGuire told him it was. Jackson stared at him for a moment, then said, "Very good. Very good. It is all right." Still, there were matters to settle in the time he had left, and Anna did her best. She asked him where he wanted to be buried, and he said, "Lexington, in my own plot." He told her he preferred that she live with her father in North Carolina. Finally, she had the nurse, Hetty, bring his daughter, Julia, in to see him. In Anna's words, as soon as they entered the door, he looked up, his countenance brightened with delight, and he never smiled more sweetly as he exclaimed, "Little darling, sweet one." She was seated on the bed by his side, and after watching her intently with radiant smiles for a few moments, he closed his eyes as if in prayer. Jackson slept. When he awoke at about 1 p.m., he received a visit from Sandy Pendleton. The two men had a very close, almost father-son relationship. Jackson asked him who was preaching at headquarters that day, the Sabbath, May 10. Pendleton, barely in control of his emotions, told him that Reverend Lacey was. Jackson had forgotten that he had asked Lacey to do that, rather than stay with him. Then Pendleton said in a wavering voice, "The whole army is praying for you, General." "Thank God," Jackson replied. "They are very kind." That included Robert E. Lee, who had attended the services and asked about Jackson. Lacey said that he was nearly hopeless. "Surely Jackson must recover," Lee replied. "God will not take him from us now that we need him so much." After the service, Lee approached Lacey again and said, "When a suitable occasion arises, tell him I prayed for him last night, as I never prayed, I believe, for myself." Then he turned away, overcome by emotion. Jackson's mind now began to fail as the last of his strength ebbed. Sometimes he would awaken and seem to be clear in his mind. Sometimes he gave orders as though on the battlefield again. During a moment of apparent clarity, McGuire offered him some brandy and water. He declined it, saying, "It will only delay my departure and do no good. I want to preserve my mind, if possible, to the last." At 1:30, he was told he had a few hours to live, and he replied again, "Very good. it is all right. Shortly after 3:15 p.m., he awoke in a delirium, crying, A.P. Hill to prepare for action. Pass the infantry to the front rapidly. Tell Major Hawks. Then he went abruptly silent. Soon, a smile of ineffable sweetness came across his face, and he said, Let us cross over the river and rest under the shade of the trees. Then, without pain or struggle, McGuire wrote, his spirit passed from the earth to the God who gave it. Chapter 46 Immortality. Even before Lee's official announcement of Jackson's death, the news was surging through the camps of the Army of Northern Virginia. It did not seem possible that, just as the Confederacy was celebrating its greatest victory, indeed the high water mark of its existence, the great warrior was gone. The jolt was crueler because until the moment of his death, the news coming from the sick room at Guinea's Station had been uniformly good. Jackson was recovering. He would live to fight again. The announcement of the death of General Jackson followed frequent assurances that he was doing well, a shaken Jefferson Davis wired Lee, and though the loss was one which would have been deeply felt under any circumstances, the shock was increased by its suddenness. Davis, the man who had once disliked and distrusted Jackson and had actively worked to undermine his authority at Romney, now proclaimed his passing a great national calamity. It was that and more. In the camps, the sounds of merriment died away as if the angel of death himself had flapped his muffled wings over the troops, wrote Raleigh Colston. A silence profound, mournful, stifling, and oppressive as a funeral pall succeeded to the voices of cheerfulness. Jackson, whose most notable personal attribute was his silence, now inspired a wave of deep, despairing quiet throughout the Army and the Southern nation. At the Chandler House, Anna Jackson could see or feel little of this. She could only observe the soldiers who had collected in the yard, hundreds of them with their hats off, many weeping openly. On the afternoon of his death, Jackson was laid out on a table in the Chandler's parlor. Because his uniform had been badly torn to treat his wounds, he had been dressed in an ordinary suit and dark military coat. His face was noticeably thinner than it had been in life, but it bore no trace of suffering. Anna found his appearance more natural than I had dared hope. She spent a sleepless night with daughter Julia by her side, and later wrote of the agony and anguish of those silent midnight hours, when the terrible reality of my loss and the desolation of widowhood forced itself upon me. The next morning she came downstairs to find Jackson in an open pine coffin, covered with lilies of the valley. As she gazed on his lifeless face, a distraught Sandy Pendleton came up and stood beside her and said, God knows I would have died for him. Meanwhile, the official machinery of death was grinding into gear. The previous day, Lee had sent a formal note to Confederate Secretary of War James Seddon. It becomes my melancholy duty to announce to you the death of General Jackson. He expired at 3:15 p.m. today. His body will be conveyed to Richmond in the train tomorrow under charge of Major Pendleton. Please direct an escort of honor to meet it at the depot, and that suitable arrangement be made for its disposition. That morning, a locomotive with a single car departed Guinea Station for Richmond, 45 miles distant. It contained Jackson's body, his wife Anna, and daughter Julia, the nurse, Hetty, Anna's friends Mrs. Chandler and Mrs. Hogue, and some of Jackson's staff. To spare herself the anguish of having to face crowds, Anna disembarked outside the city, where the wife of Virginia Governor John Letcher conveyed her privately to the governor's mansion. She was wise to have departed the train. By the time it entered the outskirts of Richmond, an immense crowd had gathered, the largest in the history of the city. The train slowed to a crawl, then proceeded ahead for 2 miles to the station, surrounded by thousands of bareheaded men and weeping women. Church bells tolled and minute guns split the air. Somewhere a band played a military dirge. All businesses in the city were closed. Black crepe hung everywhere in the city. Even the mastheads of newspapers were draped in black. At the train depot, Jackson's coffin was wrapped in a flag, in keeping with military tradition. But this was no ordinary flag. The Confederate Congress had recently authorized a new national flag, consisting of the familiar crossed bars of the Army of Northern Virginia's battle flag, superimposed on a pure white background. The old Stars and Bars, the first Confederate national flag, was considered too easily mistaken for the Stars and Stripes in battle. The first such flag had just been delivered and was meant to fly from the roof of the Capitol. But by Davis's orders, it now became the shroud over Jackson's coffin. The coffin was transferred to a raven-plumed hearse, drawn by two white horses, under military escort, to the governor's mansion. Jackson was embalmed, placed in a sealed metal casket with a glass panel so that his face could be seen, and laid out in the governor's reception room for viewing by friends, family, army officers, and official Richmond. There Anna saw her husband for the last time, and found this sealed-up version of him disappointing and unsatisfactory. Outside, the bells of the city's churches tolled until sundown, while many citizens remained in the streets. "We have never before seen such an exhibition of heartfelt and general sorrow," wrote the Richmond Dispatch. One of Jackson's chief mourners was Robert E. Lee, who could not be in Richmond because he believed Hooker might attack again. "It is a terrible loss," he told his son Custis. "I am grateful to Almighty God for having given us such a man." When he tried to tell W.N. Pendleton how he felt, he broke down in tears. Among the many soldiers who came to pay their respects that evening was Richard B. Garnett, Brigadier General of Longstreet's First Corps, who arrived at about midnight. Jackson had brought Garnett up on charges of retreating without orders at the Battle of Kernstown, and because the court-martial had never concluded, the stain on Garnett's reputation and career had remained. Jackson's treatment of Garnett was perhaps his worst moment, the charges he brought his least forgivable act. Yet now the brigadier stood before Jackson's casket with tears in his eyes. He turned to Pendleton and Douglas and said, "You know of the unfortunate breach between General Jackson and myself. I can never forget it nor cease to regret it. But I do wish here to assure you that no one can lament his death more sincerely than I do. I believe that he did me a great injustice, but I believe also that he acted from the purest motives. He is dead. Who can fill his place?" Touched by Garnett's words, Pendleton asked him to be one of the pallbearers the next day. Garnett eagerly accepted. At 11 the next morning, while field artillery detonated and a band played the haunting Dead March from Handel's oratorio Saul, Stonewall Jackson's funeral procession began. Once again, the streets were dense with people, many of whom had been waiting for hours. The procession was led by a large column of soldiers with reversed arms, then a battery with six cannons, the 44th Virginia Cavalry, and the band. Then came the hearse with Jackson's coffin, drawn by four white horses, and flanked by generals serving as pallbearers: Richard S. Ewell, George E. Pickett, Richard B. Garnett, George H. Stewart, John H. Winder, Montgomery D. Corse, James L. Kemper, and Rear Admiral French Forrest. And Jackson's riderless horse, not Little Sorrel, with boots reversed in the stirrups, and tended by his loyal servant Jim Lewis. Behind them followed the carriage bearing Anna, Julia, and Jefferson Davis. So disconsolate that he would apologize to a friend later that day for being so distracted. "You must forgive me," he said. "I'm still staggering from a dreadful blow. I cannot think." Behind them were Jackson's staff officers, McGuire, Pendleton, Smith, Douglas, Morrison, Hawks, and Bridgeford. Then a vast contingent of official Richmond, including the governor, cabinet officers, congressmen, and local dignitaries. The procession moved slowly in a large rectangle through the city streets, starting at the governor's mansion and ending at the Confederate House of Representatives, the old Virginia Senate chamber on Capitol Square. The coffin was placed on a bier in front of the speaker's chair. That day, more than 20,000 people filed past it. After the doors had finally closed, a Confederate veteran arrived, demanding to be admitted. With tears in his eyes, he pointed to his amputated stump of an arm and said, "By this arm which I lost for my country, I demand the privilege of seeing my general once more." Governor Letcher, who happened to be standing nearby and heard the ruckus, let the man pass. When it was over and the doors had shut, and the minute guns and bells had stopped sounding, people there spoke of an even worse feeling, of despondency and loss. Officers and soldiers gathered to do last honors to their dead comrade and chieftain seemed suddenly to realize that they were to see Stonewall Jackson no more forever, and fully to measure the great misfortune that had come upon them, wrote James Longstreet in his war memoir. And as we turned away, we seemed to face a future bereft of much of its hopefulness. A young woman who was visiting Richmond wrote simply, "I never saw human faces show such grief, almost despair." Elsewhere in the South, there were similar public outpourings of sorrow and loss. "Everyone feels as though he had sustained a personal bereavement," wrote the Courier in Charleston, South Carolina, voicing a common feeling. "In the agony of this overwhelming sorrow, we exclaim, 'Would God I had died for thee!'" In Knoxville, Tennessee, the Register said that for the first time since the war began, this whole nation weeps as one man. "There lives not a leader whose memory shall be cherished more sacredly than that of Stonewall Jackson, and not one whose loss we could have borne with less fortitude." In Lexington, Jackson's great friend Maggie Junkin Preston, who had kept in close touch with him during the war, though none of Jackson's correspondence with her survives, wrote in her diary on May 12, "The grief in this community is intense. Everybody is in tears. How fearful the loss to the Confederacy. The people made an idol of him, and God has rebuked them. Who thinks or speaks of victory? The word is scarcely ever heard. Alas, alas, when is the end to be?" If Southerners were feeling a strange and unsettling emptiness that seemed to transcend the mere death of their beloved general, there was good reason. The country, North or South, had never in its short history experienced anything quite like the death of Stonewall Jackson. There had been a few big funeral processions. Benjamin Franklin drew 20,000 in Philadelphia in 1790. About 100,000 came out in Washington after the death of sitting President Zachary Taylor in 1850. But neither death bore the urgency or meaning of Jackson. Neither person was considered vital at the moment of his death to the survival of the country. By the time he died at 84, Franklin was a sick, obese old man who had rarely been seen in public since he signed the Constitution in 1787. His great work in life was long finished. Zachary Taylor was an authentic war hero, but his passing had more effect on sectional politics than on anything vital to the fate of his country. Washington died at 67 and was buried quietly and with no fanfare in 1799, as was Jefferson, 83, in 1826. John Adams, who died at 90 the same year, drew 4,000 to a church in Quincy, Massachusetts. William Henry Harrison, also a war hero, was the first sitting president to die in office, and the first to get a state funeral, but it was a quiet, small-scale affair. None of these men died on the battlefield, or during a war at the height of his fame, with the very survival of his nation on the line. The closest parallel might have been George Washington's death on the battlefield at Yorktown in 1781. Like Jackson's death, it would have shattered the country's emotions and encouraged its enemies. Washington, of course, died in his bed at home 18 years later. Though history seems to have forgotten it, in part because the Confederacy exists no more, and in part because Northerners never counted it as a nation anyway, the fact is that Jackson triggered the first great national outpouring of grief for a fallen leader in the country's history. In his 1865 biography of Jackson, the Reverend Robert Louis Dabney, one of the South's leading theologians and Jackson's former chief of staff, reviewed the events in Richmond after his beloved general's death and concluded, "No such homage was ever paid to an American." He was speaking strictly of May 12, 1863. The day when the long procession wound through the streets of Richmond, and Jackson lay in state while thousands of people streamed by his coffin. What he meant by homage was not just the pageantry and ceremony, but the pure depth of feeling, the great and overwhelming sorrow that everyone he saw felt. Of course, the feeling was the same throughout the Confederacy, as the large crowds that greeted Jackson's train en route to Lexington testified. Jackson's death touched the heart of every household in the South. It was also overshadowed in history by another more momentous passing almost exactly 2 years later, that of President Abraham Lincoln. The similarities between the two are striking, starting with their symbolism. All that wild grief was not just for the two leaders. Their deaths embraced the deaths of all soldiers on battlefields far away. Their bodies became the bodies of young men who would never come home. Their funerals stood in for the hundreds of thousands of funerals of dead soldiers that would never take place. They were vessels into which the vast pent-up heartache of the American nation, North and South, could be poured. The great effusions of anguish and sorrow were for the war itself, for the totality of its sadness and affliction. "We were not in any sense spectators," wrote Maggie's stepdaughter, of the crowd at the Lexington funeral, but she might have been speaking for the entire South. "We were heartbroken mourners, a clan bereft of its chieftain, a country in peril." Drew Gilpin Faust called Lincoln's procession the national funeral. In Confederate terms, Jackson's was too. There were other striking similarities. Both men died at the height of their power and achievement, and also at the high water marks of their respective countries in the Civil War. Both men were transported back home, another idea fraught with emotional symbolism in a geographically dislocating war, by trains that wound through the countryside while grieving Americans clustered around and threw flowers. The scale, of course, was vastly different. The South did not have the concentrated populations the North did. New York was not the same as Lynchburg. In New York alone, 75,000 people followed Lincoln's cortege. But the ideas and feelings were the same. Both men were Christian heroes who believed that God was with them and against their enemies, and to their followers and supporters they seemed to be evidence that God, in fact, was on their side. Though the manner of Lincoln's death was widely condemned in the South by everyone from Richard Ewell to John Singleton Mosby's troopers and the Raleigh Standard, much of the Southern reaction to his death had to do with the fear of reprisals. Most Southerners believed, with good reason, that Lincoln would have treated them more fairly and more decently than Andrew Johnson and the Radical Republicans. Most still disliked or hated the man. But in the North there was widespread admiration for Jackson, for both his Christian piety and his warrior prowess. Harper's Weekly described him as an honorable and conscientious man, who had hesitated to take sides until secession forced his hand. British author and America watcher Catherine Cooper Hopley wrote that Northerners pride themselves that he was a fellow citizen of the Republic, an American, independent of Northern or Southern birth. There were signs everywhere of the immense respect people of the North had for Jackson's bravery and skill as a soldier. "I rejoice at Stonewall Jackson's death as a gain to our cause," wrote Union Brigadier General Governor K. Warren, soon to be a hero of the Battle of Gettysburg. "And yet in my soldier's heart I cannot but see him as the best soldier of all this war, and grieve at his untimely end." Wrote Union veteran and historian Charles Francis Adams, Jr., "I am sure, as Americans, this Union Army takes a pride in Stonewall, second only to that of the Virginians and Confederates. To have fought against him is next to having fought under him." Northern feelings about Jackson were perhaps best summarized by John W. Forney, the prominent editor of the Washington Chronicle. "Stonewall Jackson was a great general, a brave soldier, a noble Christian, and a pure man. May God throw these great virtues against the sins of the secessionist, the advocate of a great national crime." Lincoln wrote Forney immediately to compliment him on the excellent and manly article in the Chronicle on Stonewall Jackson. Jackson's beloved, estranged father-in-law, George Junkin, who had embraced the Union cause and moved north, voiced some of the same feelings. "I was completely unmanned," he wrote, "of hearing the news of Jackson's death. I sought my stateroom to weep there. Is it wrong? Is it treason to mourn for a good and great, though clearly mistaken man? I cannot feel it to be so. I loved him dearly, but now He is with dear, dear Ellie and the rest. O God, O give us grace to acquiesce in these terrible mysteries of thy providence. It is curious that though many Northerners could not forgive him for fighting, as they perceived it, to protect the institution of slavery, the Northern newspaper The Independent, edited by arch-abolitionist clergyman Henry Ward Beecher, voiced no such qualms. It said simply that Jackson was quiet, modest, brave, noble, honorable, and pure. He fought neither for reputation now nor for future personal advancement. The most famous Northern view of Jackson came from the celebrated poet John Greenleaf Whittier, whose poem Barbara Frietchie, published in 1864, became a national sensation. It described an almost entirely mythological incident from September 1862, when Jackson's troops were passing through Frederick, Maryland, on their way to the battles of Harper's Ferry and Antietam. As Whittier told it, after Jackson's troops had taken down all the American flags, the elder Frietchie had retrieved one and flown it from her attic window. Seeing it, Jackson ordered his men to shoot it down. But Frietchie caught it as it fell and held it forth, crying, "Shoot, if you must, this old gray head, but spare your country's flag." Jackson's reaction followed. A shade of sadness, a blush of shame, over the face of the leader came. The nobler nature within him stirred to life at that woman's deed and word. "Who touches a hair of yon gray head dies like a dog. March on," he said. All day long through Frederick Street sounded the tread of marching feet. All day long that free flag tossed over the heads of the rebel host. Its torn folds rose and fell on the loyal winds that loved it well, and through the hill gaps sunset light shone over it with a warm good night. None of this ever happened, but to the Northern nation, the wartime nation, the incident was as good as documented fact. What it said to them was that Jackson was a gentleman, and a Christian, and a decent person, in spite of his role in killing and maiming tens of thousands of their young men. But it also said that he was, fundamentally, an American. It was his Americanness that had stirred in him and redeemed him. The effect of Jackson's death on the fate of the Confederacy itself is harder to measure. There were many, such as historian John Esten Cooke, writing in 1865, who believed that with his disappearance from the scene, the fortunes of the South, like her banner, began to droop. Jed Hotchkiss said that nearly all regarded Jackson's death as the beginning of the end, a feeling that was reinforced by the disastrous Confederate loss at Gettysburg only 2 months later. For some, this went beyond the unsettling feeling that the Confederate star of destiny had dimmed. One soldier in the 13th Virginia Regiment wrote that men who had fought without flinching up to this time became timid and fearful of success. Such feelings were by no means universal, and there was optimism still left in the South, though in shorter supply. But the great emotional lifts of 2nd Manassas and Chancellorsville would never be repeated. Lee would never again divide his army in that spectacular way. There would be no more flashing flank marches. Robert E. Lee would never again be quite so brilliant. After the war, he commented only once on what might have happened if Jackson had lived. He was talking about Gettysburg. "Jackson would have held the heights which Ewell took on the first day," he told his brother. By that he meant that Jackson would have seized the high ground where the Union made its famous defensive stands, Cemetery Ridge, Big and Little Round Tops. There would have been no pickets charged because Jackson would have held that ground before the battle started. It's all hypothesis. We will never know. At 8 o'clock on the morning of May 13, 1863, a train on the Virginia Central Railroad carrying Jackson's remains left Richmond for the journey back to his final resting place in Lexington. At Gordonsville, the cars were shifted to the Orange and Alexandria line. At every stop along the way, large, silent crowds came out to meet the train. Many of the people wept quietly. Others handed flowers through the windows of the train, and there were soon enormous heaps and mounds of flowers and wreaths around the casket. In the days since Jackson's death, an interest bordering on obsession had developed to see the general's baby daughter. She not only had to be seen by the mourners, but touched and handled as well. Her presence seemed to make them feel better. This phenomenon had begun in Richmond while Jackson lay in state in the Capitol, and Anna received visitors in a darkened room in the governor's mansion. "So numerous were the requests to see her," wrote Anna, "that Hetty, finding the child growing worried at so much notice and handling, sought a refuge beyond the reach of the crowd, bewailing that people would give her baby no rest. Now, on the train, which stopped only for fuel and water and not to embark or disembark passengers, the clamoring was so loud that, in Anna's words, little Julia was handed in and out of the car windows to be kissed. At Lynchburg, where the traveling party left the train and boarded a canal boat for Lexington, citizens once again thronged to see Jackson's casket. The city mounted a full tribute. As in Richmond, minute guns fired and bells tolled, and thousands of people came forward and silently offered flowers. 1,500 convalescent soldiers limped forth to join the procession that followed the casket to the James River. The boat headed upstream at a laborious pace, with two mules pulling it along from the bank, picked up the North Fork of the James, and finally arrived in Lexington at sunset on May 14, where the entire Corps of Cadets from the Virginia Military Institute was there in full dress to meet it. Jackson's body was taken by artillery caisson to the VMI barracks, where he was laid out in his old lecture room, near his old chair and the cases containing his scientific teaching equipment. Superintendent Francis H. Smith ordered the lecture room draped in mourning for 6 months, and half-hour guns to be fired throughout the next day. Far into that evening, men, women, and children from the town and country came to visit Jackson for the last time. That night, cadets stood guard over his casket. The next day, May 15, his remains were taken in another long procession to the First Presbyterian Church, where he had been a deacon and had run the Black Sunday School. There, before an overflow crowd of more than 4,000, the wartime population of the town was less than 2,000, Jackson's old friend and mentor, Dr. William S. White, conducted the memorial service. He read from 1 Corinthians, "The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death," and then gave a sermon based on letters he had received from Jackson during the war, in particular, one after White's son's death. "The death of your noble son and my much-esteemed friend Hugh must have been a severe blow to you," Jackson had written. "Yet we have the sweet assurance that whilst we mourn his loss to the country, to the church, and to ourselves, all has been gain for him. That inconceivable glory to which we are looking forward is already his." It was as though Jackson were telling his country, from beyond the grave, how to think about his own death. From the church, the procession reformed, and led by 8 companies of VMI cadets, with Jackson's tearful servant Jim Lewis leading the riderless horse, moved to the Lexington graveyard, where Jackson was buried next to his and Anna's daughter, Mary Graham, and close to his first wife, Ellie, and their stillborn son. In life, he had known the place well. He had gone there countless times after Ellie's death, racked by grief and hopelessness, and feeling that God had left me to mourn in human desolation. He had wanted desperately to join her. He believed she was in a better place, a place where they would both be granted what he had once called an unending immortality of happiness.
Rebel Yell, The Violence, Passion, and Redemption of Stonewall Jackson was written by S.C. Gwynn and read by Cotter Smith. It was recorded by Erica Weintraub and Kevin Mazur. The music, Stonewall Jackson's Way, composer unknown, was performed by Anthony DeMar. Editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Ben Rimmelauer. Rebel Yell, The Violence, Passion, and Redemption of Stonewall Jackson was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Rebel Yell, The Violence, Passion, and Redemption of Stonewall Jackson is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.